Ready to launch your business? Get started with the commerce platform made for entrepreneurs. Shopify is specially designed to help you start, run, and grow your business with easy, customizable themes that let you build your brand, marketing tools that get your products out there, integrated shipping solutions that actually save you time. From startups to scale-ups, online, in person, and on the go, Shopify is made for entrepreneurs like you.
Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/setup.
McDonald's has entered the Minecraft universe. Get a limited edition collectible with a Minecraft movie meal, crafted just for adults, featuring a choice of a Big Mac or 9 Chicken McNuggets. Plus, try the new spicy Nether Flame sauce, only at McDonald's. Until 6th of May, from 11 a.m, medium or large meal, includes respective size of combination drink and side on one pre-selected collectible, while stocks last.
You are listening to the Glass Cannon Network. Your hosts, Jared Logan and Joe O'Brien.
Oh, happy St. Patrick's Day, Mr. O'Brien. We're both wearing green.
What happened?
What happened?
I know. It's like, who got the memo?
Shut off that music right now, or I'll have your job.
I love it. It gets me fired up, dude. I want to hear it.
Lose the music. It's not going away. Okay, I think it's fading.
It's fading. It's fading, yes.
It's fading.
We tried something new today. It was fun. It was fun.
Oh, that was on purpose. Okay,
that
good.
That was on purpose. Can you believe it?
Everything we do here on this show is carefully designed. It's a curated experience for you, the niche. Welcome to Glass Cannon Radio. My name is Troy Lavallee. This is Matthew Capodicasa.
Hi, everyone.
And we are going to take you through the world of the geekosphere. And we're going to talk about all things nerdy on this show. And you can call in and have your voice heard, whether it deserves to be or not. That's our policy.
Yeah, and we'll find out if it deserves to be or not right around the middle of your call. Sometimes in the first 5 seconds.
Feel free to say something that is off topic and not relevant. Other people have felt free in the past. So, Joe, how's it going? What's going on in your life,
It's going great, buddy. I'm good. Things are good.
How are those pills? How are those pills working for you in terms of extending the length of your penis?
Okay, all right. Man, two on the nose. Airing out my private affairs. I'm good, dude. I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm getting on a flight tomorrow to Seattle. We're heading to Glass Cannon Live is going to Seattle, so very excited to see the Pacific Northwest niche.
I love the Pacific Northwest.
Me too. I love being out there. I just love when we touch down in Seattle and you can just see the pine trees in the distance and the mountains on the skyline. It's the best, or on the horizon rather. The best. So leaving tomorrow for Seattle.
And the evil spirits in the wood.
Are there spirits in the wood?
Yeah. Yes, Joe. The Black Lodge is out in those woods.
Ah. I see.
It's Twin Peaks I'm referencing, sir.
Yeah, Twin Peaks, which I won't watch because I want to sleep at night.
Yeah, we did 4 episodes with David Lynch.
Yeah, but I specifically didn't watch Twin Peaks because I'm too afraid. Anyway, I'm very excited to go to Seattle. We're going to the Neptune Theater Friday night. If you're around, want to grab a ticket, come see us. And then we're driving down on Saturday to Portland and doing a show in Portland on Saturday night. So very excited for that as well. So yeah, really looking forward to this weekend. Oh, bigger news, more important news, I think, to the Glass Cannon Radio Nation. This is much more relevant. We picked a book for the book club.
Oh yeah, we picked a book.
So we're going to announce it in this episode. So stay tuned. In a little bit, we're going to tell you the next read.
We're not announcing it yet.
But we're not announcing it yet.
So get
ready
to furiously type into the comments, what is it? I have to know now.
And then when we say it, you can be like, that sounds terrible. I don't want to read it. But I'm very excited.
Just so you know, we will announce it Like an hour into the show, maybe in the second hour, and then by 6 p.m. today on the socials will just be a bunch of guys going, Reddit, just finished it, Reddit, read all the sequels, Reddit and the sequels.
I was truly staggered as I struggled to get through the first 25% of Dungeon Crawler Carl, how many comments I saw that were like, I just finished the fourth book. I was like, how?
Yeah, but this is exciting. Joe, you're going to read this book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm very excited. Yeah, so,
going to read all of it. Okay.
Well, let's not go that far. I will
you're gonna
certainly
read all
start
of it. You're going to read all of it.
Jared, tell them what we have on deck for today, because this is going to be a freaking phenomenal show.
My nipples are painfully erect at the thought of today's show. We are doing a show that it is all Dungeons and Dragons campaign settings. These are the fictional worlds that were designed and created for you and your friends to campaign in using the Dungeons and Dragons role-playing game. Although in some cases they have been converted to other systems. We are talking about Forgotten Realms, Greyhawk, Eberron, Dark Sun, all of those settings. And guys, today the topic is all settings, because that's all we're doing. That's what we're talking
about.
We're
coming at a couple different angles. We're going to do things a couple different ways. We have a couple of phenomenal guests that are going to join us. But yes, the overall theme today is the worlds that really kicked off, in a lot of ways, the play of Dungeons & Dragons, and that have a lot of sentimental value for many of us.
Yeah. For good and bad. Maybe you have critiques of them. That's good, too. I do, too. Maybe
And we want to hear from you today.
We
want
to hear that. So, you know, if you want to talk to us, you just need to be a subscriber. Then you can go to the Glass Cannon Radio stage, log right in there, raise your hand.
On Discord.
On Discord. Thank you. That's an important part of it. Yeah. Come to our Discord and get on stage, and we will call on you. Should we get right into it?
I do want to say one more thing by way of preview, which is that we are going to wrap up the show with a Beat McD. So we've got a prize on
important.
The line. And it's going to be D&D world settings trivia. This is going to be very general. It's going to be a wide range of kind of topics.
I made it really easy.
And yeah, you can go head to head with McD today in the final segment to see if you can, win our prize, which is going to be our brand new Stealth. We're calling it the Stealth GCN hat. It's a brand new, awesome black dad hat that has the logo in black on it. It just looks cool. Black logo on black hat. It's our Stealth hat. So we'll give one of those away to a winner here.
And if you get every question correct, you're going to get the new GCN jogging pants with GCN on the on the rump.
Yes.
It's on your tushy.
Love it. So sweet. Sweet CN.
Yeah. Yeah, and then what you get the tramp stamp of the planet logo right on the small of your back, and then the GCN logo on your pink jogging pants, and you're ready to go out for a night at the clubs.
All right, so let's get us started here. We have a big opener for this. Strong opener!
So excited to talk to this guy.
How to intro this? Well, I'll say this. You can see if you're watching live on Twitch. Remember, we're live every Wednesday at 12 Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. If you want to join live, you can join us on Twitch, watch the show live. And there's a graphic on screen that gives you a rundown of the topics today. Well, leading off today is Greyhawk. And why? Mm-hmm. Why Greyhawk exactly? Well, perhaps our first guest can tell you why it's such a prominent setting and why it gets first billing in today's show. Joining us today is the man who, in some ways, could we say, literally wrote the book on Greyhawk.
He wrote books on Greyhawk.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the Glass Cannon Radio for the first time, Paizo Publishing's publisher, Mr. Eric Mona. Dude!
Hi,
what's up,
everybody?
Eric?
What's
hello.
Up, buddy?
Hello, hello. I'm so excited to be here.
We're so excited to have Eric here for several reasons, which we'll get into in a second. But we also have a second guest. That's right. We got somebody else who's going to talk D&D settings with us all day today. And you know him. You love him. He's the greatest role player of all time. Our good buddy, Skidmar, is
hello.
Here as well.
All right.
Yes.
Hey.
Look at this crew.
Hello.
My goodness.
Look at this. Just 40 something guys just hanging out, shooting the shit.
Yeah.
Talking Greyhawk.
Talking?
Oh, God.
Talking Greyhawk. But before we get into Greyhawk, I want to make a special announcement. You know, for those of you that are coming to Vegas for our 10-year anniversary in June, we're doing a little retreat to celebrate our 10-year anniversary on the very weekend that we turn 10 from the release of the Glass Cannon podcast, the first episode of Giant Slayer. We've got another very special guest joining us in Vegas. That's right. Eric Mona is going to be at the retreat.
Oh, my God.
Mona.
I am so excited.
Talk awesome us through this. News. So how did this how did this come to be? And what are you excited about doing at the retreat?
Well, I am very, very stoked to be invited. I've been following your journey from almost the very beginning, and I am going to be on hand. I don't know what we're going to do yet. I'm still working it out. Maybe a little Baron Munchausen. I love that game. I got to play some Pathfinder. So I'm thinking four words, Joe. Tiny Murder Clown College. That sounds pretty fun. Yeah. I don't know what it is yet, but that sounds pretty fun. So yeah.
You people have stood in my way long enough. I'm going to Tiny Murder Clown College.
That's right.
Remember, guys,
this is
going to
be a huge party. I might start drinking again for this Las Vegas retreat.
So sorry, guys, I forgot. I got to get you on Discord here. So just hop up on stage so they can hear you as well.
Yeah, apologies. Skid and Eric were not on the Discord, but Joe's taking care of it right now.
Yeah, I'm working on it right now.
They couldn't hear you guys on Discord.
Oh, well.
We just forgot that one step. But hey, Twitch heard it. That's fine.
There's a lot of steps. It's like launching an ICBM every time.
Hello, Discord.
Key, sir.
And here I'm no help at all. I'm like, which button is the internet is my question to Joe every morning.
Yes.
So for those of you that missed it on Discord, I think we can sum up Eric's joining us in Vegas with four words. Eric, hit him with it one more time.
Tiny Murder Clown College.
Yes. What is Tiny Murder Clown College? Come out to Vegas and find out. Tickets still available. At what is the it's glasscannonnetwork.com/retreat. Is that right, McD? Is that where they can go to grab to find out about packages? I think that's what it is. Anyway, get into
come to the retreat.
Yep, that's what it is. McD confirms. Yeah. Let's get into the topic of the day.
Yeah.
Greyhawk. I mentioned to you in passing while we were at GaryCon that we were going to, at some point in the future, we didn't have a date, do a show about D&D settings. You were like, I'd love to be there. And I know that you have a passion for Greyhawk. So talk to us about where this comes from and how Greyhawk first came into your life.
All right. Well, Greyhawk was the first setting that I ever played for D&D, largely because it was, in many ways, the first setting for D&D. So when I first got the original AD&D adventure or rule books back in the day, there was an implication that there was a world behind that from Gary Gygax's original campaign, filled in by some of the other players and GMs in the Lake Geneva area, early TSR. And so we got glimpses of that through books like Rogue's Gallery that gave us stats for like Bigby and Mordenkainen and stuff like that. But around 1980, they published a little folio version of the setting, which I didn't have. I was five. But by when 1983 came around, I did get, and this is a miniature version from the 30th anniversary, but I did get this, the World of Greyhawk fantasy game setting. This was a box set. It came with a couple of books. You know, you got your guide to the World of Greyhawk. You got your glossography. Everything you need is in here. There's like 50 countries.
What is a glossography?
I know, right? There's vocabulary words. The glossography has got encounter tables. The glossography has got information about the gods and the rulers. And I mean, this came out a long time ago. So the organization is very let's call it first edition-y, you know? And
we need to change the word source book back to glossography.
I do. I think so.
Hey, did you get the new Delta Green glossography? That would be great.
Yeah, I like that. And Greyhawk is just like very infused with that early spirit of Dungeons and Dragons, you know, as informed, not to get too nerdy, but as informed by Appendix N in the Dungeon Master's Guide, which is a list of the pulp fantasy that the original creators of D&D were mostly riffing on, and I really dig a lot of that stuff. And so Greyhawk's like pure sort of 70s paperback fantasy, which has ties all the way back to the pulp era. It doesn't take itself too seriously. There's a crashed spaceship in there. There's there's some outwardly comedic adventures that you can play, but then there's also super, super hardcore adventures. Greyhawk is based around site-based adventure modules. So there's not necessarily a grand narrative. You're not always saving the world. It's like, here, there's a mound and there's lizard men in there and they're bad. You should kill them and crush their eggs or whatever. And so you kind of make the story yourself, and that appeals to me a lot. There, each country in this book has like, I don't know, two paragraphs of text. Like each one of these little things in there is a country.
Hold on, let me zoom in on that for a second.
Look at that, you know? And so,
wow, only one paragraph, but how will I know how their economy and trading laws
work? Well, I'd like to. Well, there's literally a in the glossography, there is a map that talks about all of the imports and exports from the various countries. So like
the weird thing, Jared,
is it doesn't necessarily spell it out for you in the way that a modern campaign setting might, where everything you need is at your fingertips. Everything you need is kind of in here as long as you're willing to fill in the gaps. But there are answers, you know, and so that it's like a puzzle in some ways. It's like really forces you to be a DM because it doesn't answer all the questions. It sets up all these interesting things, and then it's your job to fill in the blanks. And I think that's part of the reason why a lot of us who started with Greyhawk and have loved it, it feels so personal to us because it's a lot of our own stuff kind of in the gaps. And that's to me what D&D is all about. So I absolutely love the world of Greyhawk.
Yeah, and you got to work on it as well. You did. You did a lot of writing for Greyhawk at one point. Is that right? So, what was some of the projects you were on, and how did those come about, or what was cool about getting to work on that?
Well, the cool thing about my background with Greyhawk goes back even before my professional career, when TSR canceled a Greyhawk source book called Ivid the Undying in the early 90s. They put the manuscript up on America Online. And that was the thing that finally got me to jump online, you know, in 1993 and download that book. And when I did that, I hooked in with a whole crew of other Greyhawk fans. Greyhawk was the most popular discussion forum on AOL back in the day, I think much to TSR's surprise and perhaps chagrin, because they had just canceled it. But all of us were really excited to finally be like, oh, it's not just us. There's a community here. I got hooked up with a group of creators. We did a e-zine called the Orth Journal. And from that, I became a continuity consultant for TSR. And from that, I ended up, I'm skipping a bunch of steps, but I ended up co-writing a book called The Living Greyhawk Gazetteer, which helped launch the Living Greyhawk campaign, which to this day is one of the biggest massively multiplayer offline games ever created during the launch of third edition D&D. I wrote a version of Castle Greyhawk, the famous dungeon of Gary Gygax.
Right.
They came to me kind of near the tail end of third edition and said, hey, we're revisiting all these adventures. We've got a project called Expedition to the Ruins of Greyhawk. Would you like to write it for us? And I said, you know, what you really should do is get Gary Gygax to write that for you because it's his campaign. And they said, yeah, no, we don't want to do that. And I said, all right, I'll write it, but I am going to have to have a sidebar in there that's like, this is the fake Castle Greyhawk. This is not the real, only, you know, but there's always been a difference between the Greyhawk and Gary's campaign and the published Greyhawk. So there would already been a couple of versions of that campaign setting, or sorry, that dungeon. They just finished crowdfunding Trollord Castle Zagig like last week, which is Gary's version. So I wrote that with Jason Bowman and James Jacobs. Right. And met Gary years later And I said, will you sign my book? And I pulled out his dungeon, you know, that I wrote, and for him to autograph it. And it was probably the most sheepish question I've ever asked anyone. And he signed it really graciously. And he wrote, to Eric, a doppelganger? And then Gary Gygax. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Awesome.
So, and then when I edited Dragon and Dungeon magazine, I jammed as much Greyhawk in there as humanly possible. Some people might say too much, but you know, tough.
No, absolutely. So, so they canceled Greyhawk at one point, and that's because Gary was out of TSR, right?
Well, it limped on for, you know, of several years where they were just like repurposing RPGA adventures into Greyhawk. And then it had this bloom during the early 90s in this From the Ashes era, largely done by this freelancer named Carl Sargent, who is just one of TSR's best writers. But it was too little too late, you know, and so it finally it canceled at mid-90s.
Let's talk a little bit about the world or what's cool about it. I mean, you've already mentioned that sort of cool. The setup is like, there it is. The setup is sort of like site-based adventures, like you said, or it's a little bit more sandboxy than, say, something that like maybe Dragonlance, where it is, you know, there's an epic kind of quest storyline that's kind of developing. But I mean, what is the world like? You know, it's also worth mentioning, Wizards just chose Greyhawk as the default setting you get in your new Dungeon Master's Guide for 2024. So I was reading that rundown. I mean, what about the setting really jumps out to you, Eric?
To me, it's that it's a world informed by the genre conventions and the rules of first edition AD&D. You know, alignment is a thing. There's good and evil. And very importantly, neutrality, trying to kind of balance those forces. There's magic, you know, artifacts. There are adventurers. Adventuring is a thing. But at its base, it's modeled on medieval, you know, fantasy. And so there's peasants and there's inequality and there's, you know, it doesn't strike me as a particularly safe place. And in different parts during its development, it's been particularly unsafe. You know, that last gasp was kind of a dark fantasy approach where evil was really on the ascendance. And so I think it's got those elements are baked into the cake. It's a setting where you can just, because you went into the wrong room and a big stone block fell on you, now you're dead. And that's just the way it is, folks. This is a tough world. There's death and there's risk and there's danger and there's evil. And I know that sounds sort of generic and you'd say, well, that's true of all D&D settings. And to some degree it is. But again, I think it's built on that mindset of these dungeons being kind of meat grinders and like it. That's just the, what is a world that is based on the scientific rule book of this is the, you know, the instructions for the universe. What does it actually look like? And that's what I've always found particularly appealing.
Right. Because it started just as Gary's dungeon. It was only a dungeon for a long time.
Yeah,
it was
and then, you know, the little forest to then the city of Greyhawk as well. Right. And so that's kind of the main center of it. And then they have other interesting things. You know, one other thing I should mention about what I think so many of us love about Greyhawk. And again, this is the small version, but this is the map.
You know? I love that map.
And this was done by an artist called Darlene. And it's just... it's simple. It's beautiful. It's got a lot of handwritten calligraphy.
I have a rug of that map.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. And one of the cool things is, you know, you might say, well, Greyhawk's not the first campaign setting. That's actually Dave Arneson's Blackmoor campaign world. And I would say to that, I would say, indeed, they co-opted that and put Blackmoor in Greyhawk as well. So you get
Worry, they put it all the way there on the edge of the map.
Yeah. And I did a thing when I was doing Age of Worms Adventure Path and Savage Tide Adventure Path on Dungeon. And I'm like... people were pilfering from Greyhawk at that point, you know, like it was like, oh, we'll have a little temple of elemental evil here and we'll have this other thing. And I'm like, all right, well, I can do that. You know, we already did that. So I stole the Isle of Dread and put that in Greyhawk. You know, it's all a multiverse, fellas. You know, there's a little something for everybody.
They bleed into each other. Joe, what were you going to ask?
I need to go way back because I sorry, just a clarification of terms. I don't know what you mean when you say site-based adventures.
Okay, so think about an adventure that, like a Pathfinder adventure path, right? Where it's like, we're going to tell a story, and that story is going to have things that get put in at the beginning, and then they're going to come back, and then at the end, hopefully you've got a nice character arc, and the NPCs have character arcs, and sometimes the bad part of that is like, well, we got to keep you on the rails a little bit. You know, we want to kind of, we're telling a story. A lot of the older adventures, it's not so much a story. There's a background, but it's like, here's an ancient tomb. Go raid it and do whatever you want. And yes, there may be NPCs and little subplots within the dungeon. And of course, you can add all that stuff. The story emerges as your characters are going from the location. I'll say dungeon, but it's not always a dungeon, you know, but then you go back to the town. And then that story part is often coming from the interactions between the players and the GM rather than from the text of the adventure. So it's more about getting you to a place and then letting you kind of explore. And so
whatever you see that you just want to check out.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, you can lean into your own character motivations or do whatever, right? Of course, there's that. But there's not so much like.
But you don't have the strange aeons like you all wake up in an asylum.
Pretty rare.
And you don't remember how you got there. Start solving this great mystery.
Yeah, it's more likely to be like, you stand at the mighty doors of the looming Mare Castle. There's a strange pattern in the floor that you seem to have seen before, but you don't know what it means. How will you enter these unopenable doors? And then you're like, use an axe? You know, whatever. But like, it's not, the GM's not leading you to a conclusion or to a climax of a story. You are cooperatively telling a story that emerges through the events of play. I think it's probably the best way.
And also, I want to highlight something else you said, which I don't recall having played a lot in Greyhawk. I don't really remember what I was playing in the early 90s when I was playing second edition AD&D. But I played in your game at GaryCon this year, where we, Skid and I, had the privilege of playing in your game as one of the Circle of Eight.
That's right.
I played Big B. Skid played...
Oh, wow.
Who'd you play, Skid?
Nystol.
Nystol. Skid played Nystol, and we were 20, you know, I was 18th level. I think you were 16th or 17th level wizards, right?
Yeah.
And one of the things you said right off the bat, and then it really played out in the theme of the adventure, and you just mentioned it again here, is that importance of neutrality, which I don't think is really, that's not really a common theme in the adventures that we play.
No.
The way that we always think about it is there's good, there's evil, there's shades of gray. We love playing in Shades of Gray on the Glass Cannon Network. We like having that sort of like moral quandaries. Not everything is so black and white. Not everything is so easily discernible. We don't all necessarily enjoy being like, oh, we're a bunch of paladins fighting the evil dark lich. Like, that's not usually our MO. But we never specifically talk about how a character can be motivated to make sure that good characters are not overwhelmingly taking over the policy and procedure of the world, which is, it's kind of an interesting element of Greyhawk that you set out like right out of the gate. And as you gave our characters their kind of explanations of what their motives are, I remember, like, you know, one of my characters liked one of the other wizards, but was worried that his goody-goody sort of vibe was going to get the council into hot water or create imbalance in the world, which I was like, oh, this is really interesting. So it gives power to neutrality, which typically I think I felt was like a null result, but that's not really what it's meant to be.
I mean, I think that was very much a Gary Gygax thing. You know, the Circle of Eight that you mentioned are characters like Bigby, Mordenkainen, and Tenser, all those wizards whose names are in the spells, which is also an interesting connection. You know, I ran 2 4-hour games based in that concept where people are playing the Circle of Eight at GaryCon, and I was thrilled to have you two join me on one of those. But I would go around and sort of say, hey, what, you know, players, what do you know about AD&D second edition? Hopefully more than me. You know, what do you know about the Circle of Eight, and what do you know about Greyhawk? And relatively few people had the kind of encyclopedic knowledge of Greyhawk, but almost everybody had heard of like Big B and Mordenkainen. And so that connectivity to the original game, I think, is really important and really interesting. And I think another thing that you highlight there with the focus on neutrality is that some of the most important characters and NPCs in the Greyhawk setting aren't necessarily good guys. And so the idea of having like the big good guy group of wizards not actually be good guys, but maybe be foils or antagonists for your player characters,
right.
I think is a little more interesting to me than, you know, like, oh, Elminster's here and he's got a plus one sword to help you on your quest or whatever. So you could still do that, of course, but maybe there's ulterior motives going on with that gift from Mordenkainen.
Great. Joe, we should take some calls.
Yeah, if anybody's interested, I don't want you to feel like you're locked out of this. If you have any questions for Eric or you want to talk Greyhawk at all, raise your hand. Come up and talk to us. Bloom, you got something you want to add in, throw in? Question about Greyhawk? Bloom?
Yeah, hi.
Hey.
I use the Greyhawk setting often because I play a lot of old school games. I play mostly Pathfinder, and then like I'll run a couple like one shots or something in old school settings. I think with that like neutrality and like site based, you know, adventure, something that like a lot of people have to keep in mind is in these old school games, you gain your XP from how much gold you take out of the dungeon, not just like, you know, fighting monsters. You get very little XP from like accomplishing tasks and fighting monsters. So the characters in like these old school settings and like Greyhawk also are not necessarily going to be good guys. They're like knaves, dungeon delvers, you know, they're kind of breaking the law and they often have heroics to rust upon them later. Like if you are running like, you know, against the slave lords, against the giants or something like that, you usually start off, it's like, hey, these guys, you know, happen to do something good for us and like they're pretty strong. So like maybe we can get them to do something else. And I really enjoy Greyhawk, especially the earlier settings, because it is kind of bare bones. I love Glorian and like the Pathfinder setting, but like I've tried to read the Innersea World guide like 100 times and my eyes will just glaze over and like there's so much I know about it. And like sometimes I'll stop my players and be like, all right, you need to know this bit of information before we go on. So I like that about Greyhawk, where you know, you kind of have these maybe geopolitical.
You know, this is the publisher of Paizo, right?
He's not talking about my parts of the book that are putting him to sleep. I promise. It's only the other people's stuff.
Kind of a snooze. No offense.
Like, compared to like the Forgotten Realms and stuff like that, I really enjoy the Innersea. I feel like it's put together very well. I love the Pantheon that goes along with it.
Yeah, Pantheon's great.
Yeah,
you know, there's just so much, especially when you're running adventure paths, that your players don't need to know or they will never know. Like, if you're going to be in like Virizia, you're going to be in Sandpoint, they're not going to be really dealing with Cheliax.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you bring those two up, because Galarian is a combination of many of the writers who worked on it at the time, and Sandpoint and Virizia are from James Jacobs's kind of home campaign, and that got meshed in, and then Cheliax was from mine. And so, you know, indeed, there's not a lot of connectivity there originally, but then through Corvosa and stuff, we started to draw some connections between those things. I mean, Galarian is the other side of the spectrum, right? It's like, no, here's like a full history and all that. Galarian is what happens when the kids who got this when they were 7 spent 30 years working on it and then decided to do something a little bit more modern. But there's a lot of Greyhawk in Galarian's DNA because it's the setting we all grew up with, and there's some themes. And there's even some parallel, like almost I'd go so far as to say homages Galarian that are directly inspired from Greyhawk, like the River Kingdoms take a page from the Bandit Kingdoms, for example, in Greyhawk. So
right on.
A lot of concepts are kind of similar in some ways.
Skid and I are big fans of the River Kingdoms. We always like love the idea of like all these like small bandit lords like running their little fiefdoms is so fun. Bloom, thanks so much for the call. Thanks for kicking
us
off.
Thank you, Bloom.
It is an interesting take to think about how important that, you know, removing gold is, and then that sort of makes the main sort of baseline adventurer kind of a bad person, right? Like,
right, yeah, it's that old school mindset, like Eric was talking about the Appendix N. Like, I've read a lot of books on the Appendix N. You're talking about Conan. You're talking about Fawford and the Grey Mouser. Yeah. Mm-hmm. These are people who just wanted the gold, man.
Yeah.
You know,
a lot
get
of
that
altruists
gold out of there
in that band of adventurers, that's for sure.
Conan wasn't a good guy, you know? He did what he had to do, and
Quick question for me, Eric. I don't want to get too deep into this right now, but I'm hearing a lot about Greyhawk and its accessibility and the ability to just have a little bit, a little snippet here and there, and you fill in the blanks. What is the scope, generally speaking, of something like Greyhawk compared to what we're going to talk about next, something like Forgotten Realms? Is it actually much smaller? Are there less nations, or is there just written about
it? Yeah, I think that both. I think there are fewer nations, you know, in total, but also Greyhawk had a shorter publication cycle than Forgotten Realms did. So Forgotten Realms was able to kind of say, all right, here's the main campaign area, the Sword Coast or Faerun or whatever. But also here's Karatur, the Asian part, and here's Al-Kadim, the Arabian part, and here's, you know, whatever, Chult, the
Maztica,
the part that gets us in a lot of trouble every time we publish it, you know, and Maztica. and Greyhawk didn't quite get that. So I think in some ways, Greyhawk is a little tougher fit if what you're looking for is like every human culture is represented there. That's not necessarily the case. There's an implication that there's like an Asia, and if you want to play a ninja character from Oriental Adventures or whatever back in the day, you could do that. But it's more, it's a little bit more sort of European, Middle Eastern, a little bit of a Mesoamerican, and then sort of Scandinavia up in the top. And I'm papering over a whole bunch of other depth, of course, but it's a little bit more like taking a snippet of a world and going deep on it rather than sort of trying to be like everything to all people.
That answers my question. Let's get one more caller on Greyhawk before we move on. Mr. Morning Weave, is that what it was? Mr. Morning Wood. Mr. Morning Wood. What's going on?
Great name, Mr. Morning Wood.
M-O-U-R-N, Jared. Come on.
I've been a funeral director for many years.
Known for your senses of humor. Known for your senses of humor.
Wow.
Yes. Up top, real quick, before I ask my question, I just wanted to say I've been trying to say this for literal years. In 2019, I went to the original Texas show, in Dallas.
Oh, nice.
And, you gave me a, Joe, you gave me such a genuine hug when I met you because I had not taken a day off in literal months, years almost, to come see the show. And Skid, after the show, you actually helped me stay a little bit longer so everybody could sign a poster.
I remember talking to you because I remember talking to a funeral director like after that show.
That was a different funeral director. Tons of funeral directors come to Glass Cannon shows.
We haven't run into a lot, so stood out.
Well, I just wanted to express my appreciation, and it's actually because of y'all that when the pandemic happened I moved to New York City to help out and live here now.
Awesome.
It's been a joyous thing listening to you to all these years.
Thank you so much. You know, thank you so much.
So, but my question is for both Eric and Jared. I have been playing 5e, but mainly Pathfinder for these last years since I discovered y'all, back when. What is an older system that you think I should that I should try as a beginner to an older system, if that makes sense?
It doesn't quite to me. You're saying what's an older system you should try? You mean a game system?
Yeah, like a tabletop system.
Yeah, like among the old D&D systems, I would say. Where's a good entry point?
AD&D.
I get what you're saying. Well, of course, you should mainly play Pathfinder Remastered from Paizo Publishing. Yes. But after if you need a short break from that, then I can recommend all kinds of old school systems. I really love the people at Goodman Games. They do something called Dungeon Crawl Classics. Their system and their adventures are really beautiful, wonderful things that really, I mean, the whole point of them is to get the old school feel of those old Greyhawk adventures that Eric was talking about. There's also a game that I haven't played but is getting tremendous goodwill from a lot of people online called Shadow Dark. Which is another old school dungeon crawler.
I want to play it so
bad. It's very, very focused on the dungeon crawl. There's not going to be a lot of like outside the dungeon adventures because it even has a mechanic for when your light goes out, like how much lantern power you have. Those just off the top of my head are two really great old school systems.
This isn't an actual old system, but it's more of an homage. Mork Borg, I think, is great. We had a great time playing that, and it really simplifies a lot of these mechanics and concepts. So you can just get to playing very quickly. You create characters by rolling dice. You're done character creation within an hour for everybody, and then you just start adventuring right then. And it kind of those adventures, similar to what Eric was saying about Greyhawk, the adventures sort of write themselves based on the rules of the book. You kind of roll dice to see the world state and what you're heading into, and you only have a few days before basically everybody dies. So, like, it has a fun ticking clock that's really fun to keep game sessions quick. Eric, did you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I'm going to push up my nerd glasses here for a second and add one other recommendation. I think Shadow Dark's a really good recommendation. I also haven't had a chance to play it yet, but the people I know who have really, really enjoy it. My understanding is that they're riffing off of the sort of basic expert, sort of what they call the Beckme system, which were the, this is a whole different tangent, but that's like D&D instead of AD&D, right? Yeah. So that might be worth a look. The one that I would recommend, so here's one I'm not going to recommend, and that's just going back to first edition AD&D and trying to absorb that and read it. Someone who has grown up with modern book organization is going to go nuts with that first edition stuff. It was almost like a stream of consciousness, and you can kind of get into the groove a little bit, and it's you start to kind of like it, you know, but it's its own thing. It's a pathless land, you know, but there is a more streamlined version of that system called Osric, Osric, and that is much better organized, but is still fundamentally the original AD&D rules. So if you're curious about AD&D, but you kind of most of your backing is in modern games like Pathfinder or 5e, I might look to Osric to get a better sense of what the rules were actually like, because I think the way it's organized is more playable than AD&D.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Tiny Murder Clown. And I appreciate all of y'all for all your
most of all, remember to have fun.
thanks for the call, Morning, and thanks for the kind words. Really, really appreciate it. All right, let's move it
thank
on
you,
here
Morning Wood.
And get into the Forgotten Realms, which is, of course, a massive system that I know, you know, just the tiniest bit about. And that's why we wanted to have Skid on as well today. When we met, again, this came up during a Glass Cannon Radio. We should talk about D&D settings someday. Really motivated by Jared buying an Eberron book. And Skid talked to me. The next time we talked was like, I want to be on that show. So, Skid, I asked you what you wanted to talk about, and you said Forgotten Realms. Talk to us about what Forgotten Realms means to you.
So Forgotten Realms came around. What started, it originated in the pages of Dragon Magazine, for whom our own Eric Mona used to work, which I still think is very cool. So Ed Greenwood, the sort of creator, like this was his sort of lifelong sort of gaming setting that he'd been playing in himself. And it would be mentioned in these articles and everything. And I always loved Greyhawk. I really loved Greyhawk. But it always felt to me that like some of those details weren't expressed the way that they seem to be in some of the stuff about Forgotten Realms. The other thing is, too, is early Dungeons & Dragons art tended to be uneven. It was a little uneven in quality sometimes. It ranged from uneven to just fucking weird, like Errol Otis. Yeah. And so, there's Errol Otis. Yeah, exactly. It was that.
Can we see that one more time, Eric? I didn't
see
it.
This is what I'm playing right now in my free time.
Yeah. Yeah, just a lot of dripping stuff and mushrooms.
Some of it looked like it was scrawled on the back of a napkin.
Yeah, which it probably was, like, at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was intrigued. Like, when they were saying, it's like, we're going to release this new setting, there's like this sort of complete setting. It's just like, it felt, I was very excited. I thought, like, I think it was like 88 or something. It was just like, it finally got released, and I was so excited. And around that time, the quality of the art generally the TSR was putting out with their products was improving. And like some of the later printings of things like the Monster Manual and the Dungeon Master's Guide, like some of the stuff. It's like Jeff Easley was doing the covers of some of those things. And I actually bought a couple of his prints at Dragon Con this weekend. I got the cover to Unearthed Arcana. Nice. And then I also got here, I got the cover to the aforementioned Oriental Adventures.
Nice. Yeah.
So the art started to get a little more representative. It felt a little more kind of professional and more, it kicked off my imagination more. And then with Forgotten Realms, Keith Parkinson, like he did these books. And these are my original books. Like I still have these.
Whoa,
there it is. Amazing. Yeah, look at that.
I just think it's so
gorgeous.
And
that's also the cover of Dark Walker on Moonshade.
Yes. Right.
The Forgotten Realms novel.
Yes.
Yes.
So it just felt like, you know, with all of these like kind of stories that had been sort of trickling out like over the years, finally get like a boxed set of the setting. And I just love like the, I don't know, the box was like attractive, like everything, like the maps. I remember we had the maps, you know, came with the big giant fold out maps. Like we put them up like in my attic or like where we'd play for a long time. And yeah, just some of the, it felt like a more kind of fleshed out, coherent world. And I remember just like pouring over the encyclopedia, like with my players, with my friends, and kind of planning for what would come next for the characters. And there's a kingdom called Tethyr along the southern part of the Sword Coast. And it's sort of anarchy. It's like the monarch had died. And so it's like people vying for the crown. And so it's like, oh, you can like set up like little kingdoms. Like you can take over Tethyr. Like that sounds awesome. And then my friend Edis, he had the idea. It's like, yeah, we can set up to sort of solidify our hold over the culture. We can start a national sport to kind of get people on the same page together called Tetherball. Like, yeah, it's great. So, but then.
Well, that was a long way to go for that joke. But in the end, it was all worth it.
I think we can all agree it was all worth it.
It was. And then what really nailed it down for me emotionally was Baldur's Gate. Because when the Baldur's Gate video games came out, having them set in that setting that I was already felt so like invested in, and the two things kind of converging to make it that much more real for me, I just loved it. It also feels like you're saying this Greyhawk, the feel of Greyhawk is a little grittier. It's sort of like the Robert E. Howard, Fritz Lieber stories that Gary Gygax liked so much. Forgotten Realms felt more like high fantasy. Yeah. Like Gary Gygax, he didn't really like Lord of the Rings, for example. And this felt more like the sort of high fantasy that I liked growing up. It's just like it felt, you know.
Quick question, Skid. Do you think it makes any sense at all to not like Lord of the Rings?
I mean, I don't. I will point you. I've cited this article that he wrote in Dragon Magazine years ago, an opinion column that he wrote about why he doesn't like Lord of the Rings. And frankly, it's all bullshit. I'm sorry.
Well, that Gygax wrote. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
You know, who else didn't like The Lord of the Rings was Michael Moorcock, who was big in the Appendix N and who was, I love Michael Moorcock.
Yeah, I love Michael Moorcock.
But I also love The Lord of the Rings. But I will say this, it took me many, many, many years to have The Lord of the Rings come across to me. You have to hit it at the right time. And it's not easy literature either.
No.
You know? So if you're a dummy, stupid dummo with no brains, if you're a stupid dummy with no brains, you're not going to be able to enjoy The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. No, I get it. Well, that's the thing. It's like this column, he just displays sort of a misread of a lot of the things. I wish I had it up now. I could quote some of it, but he said like the whole thing is just an allegory for Britain's experiences in World War II. And it's like, no, it isn't. It's not.
Right. And Tolkien went on record saying it wasn't like 500 times. Like he kept going, this is not I am not talking about the wars. I am not
C.S. Lewis. Do not put
right,
me.
Yeah.
He would call the police on Gary Gygax for saying that. I'm sorry.
Well, they did call the police on Gary Gygax to some degree. So I think you have to read a little subtext to that article, which is please, please, please don't sue us because we stole a whole bunch of your shit for our game, whether I claim to like it or not. So a little bit of that was, I think, a little tap
dancing. Yeah, he was trying to distance himself from Lord of the Rings. So
these
like,
are halflings.
It's like they made us sort of like put halflings in and like all that. I didn't want to. It's
right.
So yeah, sorry. I didn't want to open up a can of worms. I just wanted
no, it's okay.
to have
but
Skid's
let's
head
talk
blow
about-
off for a second. But
no, that's okay. But let's talk about the Forgotten Realms just for a little bit longer. So,
first of all,
I love that you're
hold on, real quick. If you want to talk about Forgotten Realms, raise your hand. We'll get you in here in a second. Let's talk about the actual setting. Yes, Jared, go ahead.
Yeah. So, first of all, really good point about the art and the maps and the video games. I think as Game Master all the time, I'm trying to explain something to my players and I'm just talking to them or sending them emails when really you should send like one picture. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the illustrations, the visuals do an enormous amount toward getting something across to people. And the early Forgotten Realms products did that really well. And they looked really, really fucking cool.
Yeah.
Now, my question to you, and I don't know that you need to be the one to answer, or I'm not trying to make you defend the Forgotten Realms, but a complaint I hear a lot is that the Forgotten Realms is so kitchen sink, meaning it combines so many different things that it ends up feeling a little generic or vanilla. And this is probably somewhat a reaction to the fact that Wizards kind of just adopted it as the default setting for a while now. So what do you think when you hear that? Or does that sound right or sound full of shit to you? What do you think?
No, I think that's fair. I mean, because when you have a situation like that, when you have so many different artists and so many creators kind of working in the same playpen, it's harder to find like a coherent kind of truth about the setting that way. There's just all these different sort of hands like at work in it. So, and that's one of the things that I like about Greyhawk is that the scope just feels more focused. So you're saying it's like they don't want to represent the entire variety of human experience in this world. It's just like we're just focusing on this one thing. Whereas in, you know, with like Forgotten Realms, and this is something I liked at the time, which is just like, oh, we're incorporating like the Karatur and some of this other stuff. It's just like we're sort of knitting it into the setting too. And it's like got, you know, to the point where you did have like basically everything that you would want. And so as a setting then, yeah, it does feel a little watered down as a result. Yes, I'll agree with that.
Okay, right on. Yeah, and part of it's because as they, you know, keep updating it, they're like, and also Arakakra are a thing you can play, and cat people, and they live here. So it ends up feeling like kind of everything in the kitchen sink a little bit. What are some of the specific places or things that you've gamed in Forgotten Realms or that you really like about the setting?
I just love like, I love Waterdeep. I love some of the, just the Sword Coast. It's mostly because the thing is like my group kind of fell apart pretty soon after that setting got released. And so like most of our adventures that we actually played were in Greyhawk.
Yeah.
So the most of the playing that I did in the Forgotten Realms was through the video games.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Right on. Yeah.
So it's like Omn is a great setting. Baldur's Gate 2 is like set a lot in Omn.
How would you compare Waterdeep? I've never adventured in Waterdeep, but I played the board game a lot. I had a good time with that. I love that game.
I like that board game too.
Yeah, it's a very
Lords of Waterdeep.
Yeah, it's a very well done board game. How do you compare Waterdeep to a Galarian city? Like, is there one that it's sort of like in size, scope? Politics, anything like that?
Oh,
like,
boy.
Is it smaller than how you imagine Absalom? Is it the same size? Is it?
Sorry. I'll jump in. It'd be maybe comparable to Absalom, right? It's like the biggest city in the Forgotten Realms.
Oh, and it is the largest city, Waterdeep?
I think, probably. Don't check that, guys that are listening. Don't check anything that I say, okay? It's the biggest
city,
Joe.
It's rude to fact check someone.
Joe, quit fighting with me. It's the biggest city.
I swear.
All right. And one thing I like that they kind of retconned about it, or that they added into it in recent years, is that its technology level is a little higher than the rest of the Forgotten Realms around it. So when you're in it, it feels a little bit more Victorian. There are like handsome cabs going by.
Really?
People might have a top hat.
Oh.
Or a frock coat.
Oh.
Instead of, you know, some sort of burlap sack like they'd wear in the Greyhawk setting. it's interesting. These things sometimes, because they want to leave it open for players to do, DMs to do whatever they want, they don't really dial in too specific, because they want it to be all things to all people, right? But if you want like a really, really big city with a lot going on, with like a criminal underground and, you know, a mage school and all of the things a big fantasy city would have, Waterdeep has those things.
Let's get a caller in here. Let's get Toby up to join us here. Toby is a regular caller. What's up, Toby?
What's up?
Hey, what's up, man?
How's it going, man?
All good.
Did you want to talk Forgotten Realms?
Radio show. Yeah, absolutely. Love Forgotten Realms. what I was going to bring up is I wanted to defend Kitchen Sink a little bit, which Eric Mona has been doing already in the chat. But what appeals to me about it is that this was brought up earlier in Greyhawk, where I think every setting that you play should be something that you create alongside your players. So each setting itself becomes your unique instance of this sort of reality, this multiverse. Now, I understand sometimes the content bloat can feel a little much. You know, you have everything going on at the same time, and the sense of discovery falls away a little bit because everything already has an explanation. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think it's up to the DM and the players, or the GM and the players, to sort of make it your own. Your own sense of the magic. Is it more psychedelic, like a Moorcock, or is it more Conan? I'm a big fan. I love high fantasy, but I like my players to feel like they're adventurers. I don't want the world to necessarily understand what magic is like. I don't want everything to have a complete explanation. I want them to sort of lift themselves above the masses and become the heroes or the villains that they can be in this world. I think Skit brought this up in Legacy of the Ancients as well at some point.
Mm. So you're basically saying you like to leave sort of a lot of things unsaid or unspoken, or, you know, leave parts of the map kind of blank, and a kitchen sink is a little better for that than something where every single, say, building has been outlined and detailed, right?
It's a toolbox, because you can take those lore bits that are already there in the kitchen sink and then apply them or reshape them. Let's say one of your players wants to play a Dragonborn, right? But they don't like the limitation of Dragonborn living up to 80 years, whatever. You tie them in your own world to actual draconic blood. Make them avatars of Bahamut or whatever you want. You know, that's what I feel the kitchen sink allows you to do. Or if you want to play by leaning into the lore far more. But I would also like to hear your opinions on this.
Well, I think you're saying you're kind of talking about a homebrew now. You're saying I take whatever it says Dragonborn are in the setting, and I make it whatever my player wants. And I think that's great. I think that's a good thing to do.
I think the thing that is when we have a more detailed setting is when you want to homebrew, you feel like you're contradicting something in the lore rather than making up your own. So that's something that, you know, with Greyhawk, that felt like you really felt more permission to just do your own thing, I guess, than you do in some of these other settings. But
I will say I ran 5e D&D for like 2.5-3 years, and we just did Forgotten Realms, and the reason was all the books were just default Forgotten Realms, and that way I never had to contradict anybody about anything. You know, like if it was in one of the rule books, then yes, okay, yes, that's there, sure. So I was never going like, actually, in my setting, the philosophy is, you know, I wasn't like trying to like school them on how it was supposed to work. It was just out of the box. This is the setting.
Let's get one more call, and then we're going to move on and talk about some other settings that also kind of come under the D&D landscape. Old Blackie is has their hand raised. Old Blackie.
Howdy, howdy.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. Love the show. First time, long time.
Awesome. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate it. What do you want
Thank
to talk
you,
about?
Thank you, Old Blackie. I just want to say this is the only time I'm going to get to ever say Old Blackie in a conversation.
Old Blackie and Morning Wood together again.
In subsequent radio shows, you'll be able to call me up again there, Jared, and you'll get to repeat yourself. I love the Forgotten Realms, and I've been playing in it since it like first released ages ago. I just wanted to follow up on an interesting thread in the chat here about 4E. So in the fourth edition of the game, they basically destroyed the whole world. They had this big stupid thing called the Spell Plague, and they killed some gods and switched others out. And I think I say this for the game developers listening, the thing that was really awful about that whole experience was they just arbitrarily advanced the timeline 100 years as well, which was just like the end of a campaign that we'd been playing like since, I think, 1992 or something like that. And so it was just kind of jarring. And arbitrary. There are some elements to the 4E Forgotten Realms that I think all of our players really liked. You know, Netheril coming back after a 10,000-year hiatus in the Shadowfell and, you know, changing the very center of the map was cool. But there were some things that I just found gross. And, you know, I might be the odd guy out here, but, you know, bringing in races like the Dragonborn and all that sort of thing was just kind of like unsettling to kind of like old school players. You know, for me, when I'm DMing and we're starting to make new characters, you know, I need people to give me a good reason why they want to play a half elf. So, you know, a dragonborn was just a little bit of a stretch. Anyway, I think you guys would be interested to hear that we've returned to Pathfinder. But we actually play Pathfinder 2 in my Dagger Falls setting. So, you know, Forgotten Realms, but Pathfinder 2 rules. And that seems to be kind of a fun balance. The only downside, which kind of Jared was talking about, is, you know, the materials, you know, the gods are a little bit different. So using Hero Lab Online, you know, you got to kind of jury rig things together. But overall, love the Forgotten Realms, but really like the Pathfinder 2 system. That's what I have to say.
Interesting. So,
cool. Thanks for the call, Old Blackie.
Thank you, Old Blackie. So when a game developer says, okay, now we've killed off these gods and things are different, does that really bother people? Because, you know, you can still just play with the old gods, you know, you can still just make it.
I think people,
you're the one running the show.
Like, I think people put a lot of stock in the world state as published by the publisher. I feel
they do. They do. And I wonder if that's correct. You know,
Eric,
if people do want to play with the canonical Forgotten Realms gods, might I recommend the book Faiths and Pantheons by Eric Mona and it is your definitive guide to the third edition pre-spell plague pantheon of the Forgotten Realms. I had a chance to co-write with Eric this book, and I was like the staff Greyhawk guy, you know, and they're like, you want to write this Forgotten Realms book? And I'm like, yes, but also, oh my god, no, because there's so much continuity and everything. I love that. I think part of what happened with the spell plague and the shift in fourth edition is there was a mindset at Wizards, and I was working there around that time, and I think there was a mindset that continuity was like an expense that only a small number of people cared about, and if we could divorce ourselves from having to care about any of that stuff, we could start fresh and focus on all the awesome stuff that today's D&D fan wanted. And so I think there was a little bit of hubris that went into that decision to move the timeline, and it left a lot of players behind. And not just players who were like, well, I don't want Dragonborn in this setting that's never had Dragonborn. I mean, the brand's got Dragonborn, so there's going to be in the main setting, I guess. But also, like, they kind of killed their entire novel line by doing that, because all of the ongoing characters are now dead.
They're all dead.
You know, in the modern version of the campaign setting, or elves or something. So luckily they still were able to get Drizzt, you know, back because he's an elf. But I think that was a huge mistake. And I think it alienated a lot of people. There's this sense in the industry of like, oh, a new edition, we've got to do. It became known as like a realms shaking event, you know, like the original Time of Troubles. Even Greyhawk had that with the shift to second edition, where it's like, oh, all monks and assassins and half-orcs are now dead. And you're just like, what? I don't want that. But that's what the brand wanted. And so there is this discongruity between what the company needs and wants and what the players need and want. And balancing that at a time of an edition shift is really, really tricky. And I think the fourth edition Forgotten Realms shift might be the best example of the worst approach to that, at least in terms of how, what
that's really interesting. That's really interesting. And thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. That's interesting conversation. I will also say quickly, as you can see, I don't have much to add to these conversations. I'm not really well read on these settings, but I got back into D&D and Pathfinder right at the time, right around 2010, right in that range, I started playing again, and fourth edition was out, and I grabbed fourth edition. And the first thing that I remember is hating Dragonborn. Like, I got to that page, and I was like, what is this nonsense? Like, I don't know. It
very
just made
polarizing.
Me mad.
Well, yeah, Dragonborn like opened the door to now so many D&D parties. Like, it's a rabbit person and a cat person and a living tree and not a human among us.
I'm an onion. It's just all this like ridiculous stuff.
Yeah.
That'd be crazy to publish a game like that.
Yeah. Well, look, everybody
Give
likes
the people
what they
what
like.
They want,
I get
sure.
it. I get it. But I see why people want it. I think Troy and I agree on this too. We talked about this, you know, 10, 15 years ago. We were just like, I just don't get, like, you lose so much of the mystery and fear and awesomeness around dragons when you're just like, I can just be one now. To me, I was just like, oh, it bothered me so much.
I feel like anything can work depending on the context and who's playing. And you know, I totally get that reaction when you see the
but
dragonborn.
I also think
going,
that in
what?
My own mind, I think it's a double standard because I also loved, you know, the ability to have. You know, tieflings and Nephilim and stuff like, you know, where
some
you have
people hate tieflings.
I know some people hate that you can have partial like demonic blood or fiendish blood and hellish blood or whatever. Like, and I think that's really cool. So it is.
I think it's hilarious and awesome that anytime you talk about half orcs or half elves or tieflings, you're bringing sex into your tabletop role playing game. You're implying sex and, you know, I just think that's always very interesting that the way companies have to kind of handle that.
We're going to move on here. We need to get to so much more fun stuff, including what we're a segment that we'll get to in 1 second called Elevator Pitch. But before that, let me pitch to you. Actually, this isn't a pitch. This is a decision. We have the next book for our book club. So, Eric, we do a thing here on Glass Cannon Radio called Book Club, where we will pick a book, everybody reads it, we give everybody 1 month, and then we come back on the show, we talk about it, callers can weigh in, etc. We did our first book back, 6 or 7 weeks ago, called Dungeon Crawler Carl. It was the first lit RPG, that's what they call it, right? That genre. I had never read it before.
Maybe not the first, but definitely the most popular.
I'm saying it was the first one that we did on this show and the first time I've ever heard of the genre. But so we read that and everybody called in, weighed in, gave their thoughts, etc. And now we're ready for another book. We don't always have a book back to back to back ready to go, but now we're ready. So, Jared, why don't you tell, you brought this to me. I gave it a quick glance and was like, I'm in. This looks right up my alley. Let's try it. Tell them what we're doing next.
So this is a really big fantasy novel. I think it came out last year or the year before. And everybody is raving about it. Some of you may have already read it. That's great. You can be part of the conversation. We are going to be reading The Black Tongue Thief by Christopher Bullman.
Ooh.
The Black Tongue Thief. Ooh. That's it right there.
You can see, Joe, show them the length. Show them the length of the length, book.
Yeah. How thick
See, that is manageable, everybody. It's very manageable.
I'll open it up right here. It's just shy of 400 pages. Just shy of 400. Wow.
That's a breezy read, everybody. And from what I am gleaning so far, it is kind of a dark fantasy, but with a lot of humor. And Bulman is an author all of my fantasy fan friends are talking about. So I think we're all really going to enjoy this. But if anybody hates it, please call in.
Yeah, it's going to be great. I'll probably have negative opinions. I often do. It's so rare for me to like a fantasy book these days, but because I'm a grumpy old man. But this I'm very much looking forward to. And the other reason I said yes when Jared pitched it to me is I got this from my local library. So check your local library because this is popular enough to be in your library. So check it out and read it in 1 month.
Yeah.
We might need to tweak it to about 5 weeks based on our schedule, but in about that time, we'll come back on and talk about it.
When we do Glass Cannon Book Club, we're probably not going to pick obscure books. Hopefully it's in your library if we're picking it.
Sure, but I mean, to me, it's always like, especially when you're picking fantasy and sci-fi, if it's not like a classic, it might not be in there. You know, you want to double check and make sure.
It's true. You're absolutely right.
But this one was
in
there, multiple copies at multiple local libraries that I saw through my card catalog. So yeah, it's... check it out.
Hopefully President Trump helps libraries. I feel like that's going to be a big...
That feels like an area of focus that he would be interested in.
Yeah.
I really like
Big reader.
Loves,
Not to change the subject, but I really like the cover design on that. It's got a very, very retro
it's
looking...
It's very cool.
Yeah,
it's
cool. It looks like cool. They're riffing on specifically...
It almost has like... to me, my first thought was like Neverending Story, kind of. Mm-hmm. You just have these like two adventurers on kind of like a black and white, and they're walking through these like massive cliffs to some unknown thing in the distance, and it's all kind of black and white. I love it. I think it's really
cool. The font choices and the limited color palette remind me, they're riffing off of, let me get super nerdy. I just came back from a paperback and pulp collector show like 5 days ago. So they're riffing off of a thing called Gnome Press from the 50s that published a lot of this stuff the first time. So Conan was in there. And that I really am going to put myself out on a limb and saying that they're specifically trying to make that book look like one of those old Gnome Press, kind of the Arkham House of fantasy and science fiction.
Cool.
Yeah, pretty cool.
So one more time for our audio listeners, it's called The Black Tongue Thief. The author is Christopher Bulman, B-U-E-H-L-M-A-N, B-U-E-H-L-M-A-N. Search for it, read it, and then come and talk to us about it. All right, let's get into a segment that we're calling Elevator Pitch. We knew we only had so much time for this show. Obviously, we could do a two-hour show on Greyhawk. Obviously, we could do a two-hour show on Forgotten Realms.
You could do a whole podcast on it,
of course. But look, we're just sort of like focusing on this today and touching on these topics and giving everybody a little bite-sized taste. So Elevator Pitch is going to be, I want to hear everybody around the horn here, Jared, Skid, Eric, and McD, we're going to get involved. I want to hear everybody give me a quick pitch on these other D&D settings that I have never played in. A quick pitch of like, What is it, if you were pitching it to your players, how would you do it quickly? What grasps the spirit of the world and the setting? And we'll see, how these go, and then we'll talk about them for a little bit. So we're going to start off with Jared. I want to start off with Jared out of the gate. This whole thing came up because you bought a book about Eberron. So give us the elevator pitch for Eberron.
So, elevator pitch for Eberron. I also recently read an Eberron novel, which I'm not sure if that was the best decision, but I did finish it. Eberron, I think it's truly a great setting. And
you're on the
my
clock,
pitch
by the
is, way. Oh, God in heaven. All
Keep
right.
It
so, look, modern fantasy is not just Tolkien, right? I mean, when you talk about modern fantasy, you're talking about his Dark Materials, maybe, or the Final Fantasy video games, or anime like Full Metal Alchemist. Eberron acknowledges those things are part of fantasy and creates a fantasy world that includes stuff like that to create like a setting where imagine a fantasy world, but the timeline has moved up 200 or so years, 300 years in the future. So it's not a medieval fantasy world anymore. It's an industrial fantasy world. So there's all this technology that runs on magic. Like there are trains and there are airships. Two things that are very cool in role-playing games, trains and airships. But there's also, light bulbs, like electric lighting, but it's all done through magic.
Oh, cool.
Long distance communication, kind of like radio, all done through magic. And there are all these guilds. They're actually called the dragon-marked houses that run all of these businesses and have monopolies on them and are constantly vying against each other to get contracts and beat each other out and make more money and the other one. So the politics of the world is the default start point for the game is four or five years after a giant 100-year war that spanned the entire continent, and it ended. The war ended when someone magically nuked a country in the middle of the continent, and no one knows who did it. But the middle of the continent is now like this magical wasteland because someone magic nuked it, right? And created this thing called the Morning. So you start out in a world that's kind of like post-World War I or maybe post-World War II, where all of these nations have called a truce, but tensions are really high. They called a truce because of this magical nuke that happened, but they're still scheming against each other. There are spies, you know, moving back and forth. There are the dragon-marked houses I mentioned. It really feels like a kind of a 20th century pulp noir fantasy world. And I'm not even getting into the incredible like types of creatures you can play. You know, it adds to like the playable races Warforged, who are like these robots that were built to fight in the war, but now they have no war. So what is their purpose? Or Changelings, who are like the perfect spies because you could play a playable race that can just change their appearance at will, like shapeshifters.
You've got 10 seconds.
Okay, and I'll just say, this is the greatest setting for people who are like, I want to play Call of Cthulhu, but my players will only play Dungeons & Dragons. I want to play, you know, Blade Runner, but my players will only want to play Dungeons & Dragons. I want to play Star Wars, but my players will only play Dungeons & Dragons. This setting covers you and lets them play Dungeons & Dragons while you play something different.
Okay, that's it. That's very cool. Good job. That's a little over time, but we'll allow it. I gave a max of 3 minutes, so that was great.
I didn't know this would be so gamified, Joe.
It's not gamified. It's just we actually have to keep it going for the show.
Yes, fair enough.
I do have one. Here's my quick question for you. How would you compare technology, setting, feel, vibe, Eberron compared to Duskfall? From Blades in the Dark, the way you described it seemed a little similar. How would you describe the differences or similarities there?
I mean, as written, Duskfall is more Victorian, right? The Blades in the Dark city is more Victorian, and Eberron is a little bit more 1930s, 1940s.
Said industrial versus Victorian. All right, that answers the question.
But I mean, you know, there's wiggle room in there, obviously, when you're playing your game. You know, if you wanted to feel a little bit
Duskfall
more Victorian,
has trains,
there's no reason
right?
you couldn't.
It has airships. It's kind of interesting. But,
right,
yeah,
exactly,
anyway,
yeah.
Good summary. Let's go to Skid. Skid, how about you step up to the plate here? What setting do you want to give us an elevator pitch on? These are all D&D settings. There's just so many. What is another D&D setting you want to pitch?
All right, picture this. A world, a post-apocalyptic fantasy world, wrecked by magic. As a result, magic is mistrusted and rare. But psionics are rampant.
Oh.
This is the world of Athas, of the Dark Sun setting. I just love this because I love, you know, obviously I love post-apocalyptic stuff. I've always said that like medieval Europe is basically a post-apocalyptic landscape. And this goes really hard into it. It's based on the imagery of the artist Brahm, who was great. Like he did the covers for a couple of the Book of the New Sun books that I loved. Really, really like, really, really hardcore, really gritty. Do you have, there's a lot of like gladiatorial, like there's slavery, there's want. It's full of like deprivation and hardship. Halflings in the game are cannibal savages. And in fact, I believe, and I've never been able to play in it, but I believe what I remember is that new characters in the game, by rule, start out at second level, because if you were at first level, you couldn't even survive in this setting.
That's so cool.
So that's my pitch, is Dark
nice,
Sun.
Nice. And 1 minute and 20 seconds. Good elevator pitch. Good elevator pitch. It sounds very gritty.
Very gritty.
Real grit. I mean, it's Dark Sun, but it does sounds dark. Like,
it's in the tradition of, like, the Dying Earth kind of fantasy stuff, which I also love. So,
gotcha. Yeah. Okay, very cool. Let's do another one. And if anybody wants to call in or revert back to any of these, we're going to try to make time for that by keeping these elevator pitches short. McD,
I just want to throw something in there, Joe. There are Pathfinder 2E conversions of both Eberron and Dark Sun made by fans. So if you'd rather play in the Pathfinder system, you can still play these settings. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Awesome. McD, are you ready? You could just like hop in on Discord if you want, and we'd love to hear a pitch from you, an elevator pitch on a D&D setting. You got something?
I do, buddy. This one will take us both back. It's my comfort food D&D setting. Because I grew up playing like AD&D basically with my dad, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like old modules like Castle of Amber and Secret of Bone Hill and all that, which felt like it was cool. It was generic fantasy. It was very vanilla. But then I read the Dragonlance novels. And the Dragonlance books, I mean, Joe, we've played through at least the first part of Dragons of Despair. I couldn't tell you how many times we started that.
Just kept restarting
that module. And here's the pitch on it. I'm not sure how this converted to 5e. I mean, I'd hate to make somebody play AD&D second edition. I don't know what that would do to somebody's brain now. But what you get out of it is you play with pre-built characters. You're playing the characters from the Dragonlance novels, and that's how adventure path is meant to be played through, right?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Exactly.
I love those characters. I mean, after you read so many of those books, they really, very three-dimensional and awesome characters. Yeah,
100%. And as someone who always plays a cleric, it's fun to play in a world where clerics are revered. Well, no. After Dragons of Despair, you get the discs of whatever, and you restore clerics to the world, and then you can actually play as a cleric. And clerics are powerful, and the most powerful, and revered, and scared. People are
scared.
Who
was the
clerics.
One cleric in the Golden? What was her name? Goldmoon.
Yeah. So yes, that's my pitch. Take it way back. Go ahead. Play some AD&D Dragonlance.
1 minute, 57
seconds. I love those
books. Well done. Under 2 minutes. That's really, that's McDermott literally gave me, you didn't even give me Dragons of Autumn Twilight. You gave me the first book of the meetings sextet. I remember you were like, you should read this. Cause this is when like the characters like first meet each other. And I remember looking at that book. I was not a reader like in middle school. I was just like, all I wanted to do was play sports and video games. Like I had no interest in, I was like, look at the size of this book and how tiny the writing is. I was like, this is ridiculous. And I started reading the meetings and, what is the name of that first novel? I feel like I can
Dragons of Autumn.
No, that's the
Dragons
Chronicles.
Of Autumn Twilight. That's the Chronicles.
That's the Chronicles. The first meetings. Somebody will have it pop up in a second here on chat, I'm sure. But anyway, that book was awesome. And then
Kindred,
I ended up reading
Kindred
like
Spirits, buddy.
Kindred Spirits. That's it. Kindred Spirits.
Tannis and Flint getting up to business.
Tannis and Flint. That's right. All right. Good stuff. Eric, I was having an issue with your mic a second ago. Can you? All right, great. We can hear you great now. Perfect.
Here I am.
I just wanted to double check. Last elevator pitch, Eric Mona, the floor is yours whenever you're ready to begin.
Are you an Apex Dungeons & Dragons player? Are you jaded and bored with things like living gods and crashed spaceships and dungeon levels patterned off of Alice in Wonderland? Is that all getting a little tired for you? Well, why not go into the great beyond? Why not venture into the land
of Planescape. Yeah. Planescape is the 90s campaign setting from TSR, wherein they went into the outer planes in a major, major way. And it was kind of similar to Dark Sun at the time. One of the first D&D settings that was, I think, really competently art directed and designed as a place where you could inhabit and live. So there's this slang called the cant that's fairly corny, but also kind of fun, patterned off of like Victorian, you know, criminal slang. There's planes with giant metal cubes crashing into each other, and there's planes where Sigil, the great city, is on the inside of a torus. We all know what a torus is. It's like a donut, and it's rotating around a big, giant, and possibly tall spire that is like a spine of all of the planes. It's the great wheel cosmology writ large. Have a drink with a demon. Play chess with an angel. Smell the farts of a demodand, whatever it may be that you're excited about. Planescape kind of takes things to the next level. It's crazy. It's goofy. It embraces some of the weirdest elements of Dungeons & Dragons, like the geometrical shaped Modrons are a big part of it.
I love Modrons.
There's factions that you can join up that have philosophies that kind of take alignment even further. It is the end game of Dungeons and Dragons, essentially. And on top of that, if that's too overwhelming, if literally an infinite number of infinite planes is too much, I mean, you are an Apex D&D player at this point, so it shouldn't be. But if it is, you can just use these Planescape things, like, for example, the several appendices of different creatures that they put out over the years of monsters like, you know, look at that. Tony DiTerlizzi art. I mean, amazing.
Oh, amazing art.
These are great resources, even if you're not venturing off of Greyhawk or the Forgotten Realms or whatever, and you just want to have cool summoned creatures or creatures from the Outer Realms or whatever. Planescape is your answer. Definitely, Spelljammer aside, the weirdest campaign setting that TSR ever did, and certainly one of my absolute favorites.
Whoa! Yeah, amazing.
2 minutes and 57 seconds. Just under the wire. What a professional. Well done, Eric. That was, I think that was the best pitch. If we're talking about a pitch, you were really selling it.
Yeah. I'm not just selling the setting. I'm selling your sense of your own identity.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, are you so awesome that you need more? He's like, yes, I am. That was so fun. Thank you guys so much. Let's take a call or two before we move on. Anything else you guys want to add into these settings that we just pitched or any other, I don't know, settings that you want to pitch yourself? Asteron, do you want to come up to the stage here and chat with us?
Hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Hello.
Hey.
Good. How are you guys?
We're doing great. Man, this is doing I'm having well. A great time. What do you want to add here?
Well, I just want to add, I spent most of my time in Forgotten Realms. Mm-hmm. But my favorite setting is definitely Eberron.
Oh, okay.
And the reason for that is I love the magic tech of it. But I loved one of the novels was set in a country called Dargoon. And Dargoon is like what Oprak is in Galarian, but it was done like so well, like it was like goblinoids and ogres and whatnot,
right.
Broken off and set up their own country.
Yeah, so you know how lately a lot of games, I'm sorry, Astron, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but lately, you know, finally Wizards has gotten on board with like goblins and orcs, you know, maybe not just being evil creatures, right? Eberron kind of was doing that before anybody else. Like Eberron, like all the way back in the early 2000s was like the alignment, throw it out. Goblins have their own society. You know, they are not necessarily just evil mooks to destroy. So that is an interesting thing about Eberron. It kind of did that early.
Adam West had something to say. Adam West, 4913, if you want to come up and chat. Adam?
Hi.
Hi.
Wanted to do the pitch for Planescape, but Eric Mota did a way better job than I would ever try to do. So thanks, Eric, for that. I also had a first inspiration for the planar travels from reading the books of Pathfinder, and just the idea of going to shop with Ifrits on a plane of fire, or traveling the River of Souls through the astral plane and hopping the outer realms, going to see the realms of gods. So that was a set campaign setting that I couldn't quite do myself earlier, and I'm eager to do soon.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah, sorry. It's a little hard to hear you on your mic, Adam, but another vote for Planescape there, and for
Planescape. Yeah, that's Planescape's the way to do your psychedelic campaign for sure. If you're into Moorcock, you should play Planescape.
Also the setting for maybe the best Dungeons & Dragons game ever made.
Yeah, the video game. Yeah. Torment. PC game, right?
Video game, yeah.
What is it? Is it Planescape?
Yeah.
Planescape Torment.
Yeah, yeah. So I know that name. I didn't realize that was so funny. I never put that together. That's a D&D setting. RT Nix, if you want to come up, let's take a call from RT Nix. A lot of people want to get in here, and I'd love to just get a few of you before we have to move on. RT is not answering. Oh, wait. Are you there? Your mic is muted on your phone. If you just unmute that real quick, we should be able to hear
you. Hello.
There we go. Hello. What's up, RT?
Hey, long time, first time.
Welcome.
So, yeah, I'm going to throw myself into the same pool as I was going to stump for Planescape, but Eric beat us to it, of course.
Wow. Yeah, a lot of Planescape.
I ran a Planescape campaign in the mid 90s for several months. And one thing that Eric didn't, I don't think he mentioned, that was actually something. So, when Jeff Grubb's Manual of the Planes came out towards the end of first edition, and even before that, like, The Outer Planes, all that area was really just kind of a playground for super, super high level characters.
Yeah.
And one thing that was great about Planescape was it made it so there was a place that low level adventurers could actually do stuff in the planes and not die instantly. The whole kind of cosmopolitan nature of Sigil, and the way that, you know, like you said, angels and demons having a drink at the bar together. It wasn't an automatic instant death kind of a situation for players, which was great. And then another thing that I was actually always kind of a fan of is because you've got super easy access to the different domains in the Outer Planes where the gods reside. And it was always so, like, when Dungeon Magazine, you know, which was the magazine TSR did, where people could send in their adventures and get them published. Anytime somebody anytime somebody would publish something that had to do with, like, a historical setting, like an adventure that maybe had like a Celtic flavor or a Greek flavor or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of hard to stick those into a homebrew campaign usually. But I mean, if you were doing Planescape, you know, you could just travel to the domain of whatever deities and kind of set it in the area there, because you had people that lived in the domains of those deities on the Outer Planes called petitioners, which are basically like the dead souls of people who went to that deity's realm. And it was great for that.
Cool.
That was excellent. I don't know. It was a very formative period for me, like the campaign that I ran for that. And it was also a great way to bring in characters from a bunch of different settings. Like the campaign I was running, we had a character from Dragonlance in there. We had a character from Dark Sun in there. And then a couple of like planar natives. So it was really the most kitchen sink of kitchen sink settings in a way.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the call, RT. Man, all the callers calling in for Planescape. It was either Mona's pitch or I'm missing something with Planescape. People love Planescape. Feline Machine, why don't you come up and say your piece? We're going to move on here in a second. I'm very excited for this next part. Feline.
Hey, guys.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm a big Planescape guy myself, but I'm gonna throw in the hat for Spelljammer. Because what if every race, every country, in every setting had a secret space program?
And now that is an elevator pitch.
You only needed 10 good. Seconds and I'm in.
And they fought dope-ass wars in space, and also the elves were Nazis. So you could hate elves, you could hate people that hated elves, and you didn't have to feel bad even a little bit. Spelljammer was incredible. That was my... that was my first like big setting that I ran like for years and years and years. It was such a blast. And it, like, they went out of their way to describe physics in game, like fantasy physics. It was nonsense. All the planets were crystal
phlogiston, right? They talked a lot about phlogiston.
In phlogiston? Rainbow gasoline called phlogiston, yes.
Yeah.
And you took portals between the different realms. It was the most ridiculous thing ever, but I loved it. And they had all this like implied like history that they would reference. They would talk about the Inhuman Wars. And like they never explained it. It was just a thing that happened, and they sort of implied that giants had spaceships. And you're like, wait, what? They had giant stone like galleons made of rocks.
That sounds fucking cool, man. Imagine a giant stone spaceship lands, and then 25-foot-tall people get out of it.
Yeah.
That's fucked. That's a good campaign right there.
Yeah.
For sure.
Good and hook.
The one thing I'll add on to Planescape that I don't think anyone had mentioned yet was my favorite thing about it was when you went to the outer planes, you had to follow the rules of the plane in order to actually travel. Like you would go nowhere if you didn't sort of play along with what the plane wanted you to do. So I just thought that was the most fascinating thing.
One example?
Yes. Bytopia. It is like the plane of gnomes. So they're like, it's all about hard work. Like if you're not on your feet doing work, you literally get left behind by the rest of your party. It was the most ridiculous thing. So we had like a character who was just like, I'm lazy. So he'd hop in the back of a cart and he'd get left behind. He'd wake up after a nap, like, wait, where'd everyone go?
Yeah, that's cool. All different rules. Thanks for the call, Feline. All right. Awesome. Well, that was really fun, guys. Thanks for doing that. You crushed it. And, obviously we could go deeper into these, settings on different days and different themes. You know, we'll talk more about this stuff as, we have different theme shows, but let's for right now, talk about settings prep. So this is a segment that comes up from my own experience. And I want to throw this out to you guys, get some of your thoughts. And if we can get a call or two in, that would be great as well. I am gonna so you mentioned earlier Corvosa, Eric Mona, and Corvosa, who was behind Corvosa in terms of writing, say, the Gazetteer for Corvosa? Do you remember who created that, who wrote that, who contributed to that?
Primarily James Jacobs, our creative director on the narrative side at Paizo, and the guy who wrote the first adventure for the Rise of the Rune Lords, Pathfinder number one.
Yeah, so
from the beginning.
I think I'm having this right. I believe that the Curse of the Crimson Throne is set in Corvosa. Yep. And so I was getting ready to run this adventure path. And so I grabbed the Corvosa Gazetteer, and I devoured it. And I mean, it's whatever, 60, 80 pages long, just about this city. And it is not the kind of thing that I'm interested in reading. And as I was reading it, I just couldn't stop. It was so good, so deep, so well explained. And I got immersed in the world. This is all to say that when I started my campaign for Curse of the Crimson Throne, I kicked it off by basically beginning what I had no intention to be, but which ended up becoming a more than 90-minute, now it's 2 hours, now we're going over 2 hours, lecture on just introducing this world. Because if you want at this setting, really, because if you want your players to understand and build characters that are enmeshed in the factions of the city, that understand what it means to be a Varisian here versus what it means to be a Chalaxian here, two very different definitions of how you're going to be treated, how you're going to be responded to, how whatever. I wanted everybody to kind of understand all this depth. Well, I realized more than halfway through my lecture that this was a mistake. Like eyes were glazing over, nothing was sinking in, and people came to play Pathfinder. They didn't come to get a history lecture on this city. And so the question that I bring up here is, let's say you're really excited about running a game in Dark Sun. Let's say you're really excited about Eberron. I mean, Jared, this is something you actually want to do, like coming up, like you want to run a game in Eberron.
Yeah.
You have to describe, I feel like, a lot of detail to players who are going to create characters in a given setting that has different rules for technology, different rules for races and classes and stuff like that that are all renamed and done differently. What are some tips you would give to how do you introduce a new setting to a group of players? And I'm not talking about the elevator pitch where you get them to buy in. All right, I'll try it out. I'm talking about actually making characters and starting the session so that they can. How do you get them hooked in early without spending too much time lecturing about what makes the setting unique? Jared, I'll kick it to you first. Any thoughts
on this? Me first. Okay. Well, I would love to hear what Eric and Skid have to say, but I guess, obviously, based on what you just said, I think it's right. You don't give them a long lecture about history or culture
currency.
Or the differences.
I was going into what each, like, gold is called this. Yeah, silver is called this.
You don't need to give them a complete rundown of the political factions. That's not going to work. A couple things I wrote down were make a list of movies, TV shows, books, and video games that are like the setting you're going to run.
Mm-hmm.
Show them that. Skid hit on it earlier, talking about the Forgotten Realms. Show them pictures. Show them illustrations. If you can, give them the books. Like, and let, don't force the books on them. Don't show them things in the books. Just give them the books ahead of time and let them look through them, right? And, yeah. You know, more often than not, they'll get it. But, and then one other advice I have is I think no player really minds if you limit their choices a little bit. So if you want it to be a really dark, sunny, dark sun game, maybe you go, hey, we're using these classes and races. We're not using these, right? Like, so there are not going to be any.
You start off with like, make a choice of these three. Right. Like,
yeah, or maybe, maybe there's more, but you know, we're not doing gnomes because gnomes aren't dark, sunny or whatever. And nobody minds that. Nobody, I don't think anybody gets irritated at that because players have so many choices anyway. They're always overwhelmed. So you can narrow down the choices to things that you think are really thematic. And then finally, then you just have to show them. Like, don't explain too much. Just run an adventure that kind of really shows off what this setting is like compared to other settings. Mm-hmm. That's a tall order, but I would say always when you're doing these things, get to playing as soon as possible and just show them because they'll get it when they play it. They'll be like, oh, I get this now, you know.
Doubling down on the art, War Historian on Twitch chat says, surround them with art from the setting. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a good way to put it. It's just splaying out art all over the table. Or if you do it Order of the Amber Die style, literally hang tapestries from the walls that give the vibe of what you're seeing. Cover the windows to the outside world with images of what you're
cover
about to play.
Cover the windows to the outside world. Lock the doors.
Hold
pots
them
on
hostage.
The floor for shitting
you
in.
You can't leave until you understand this whole setting.
Take
Eric,
their phones.
Eric, any insights on this? Anything that you'd like to add to how do you bring a new setting to a table and get playing as soon as possible, but still feel like you're doing justice to the world?
I think it's a great question, and it's something I've had to deal with fairly recently because I just started a new D&D campaign. I wanted to play some of the old adventures. I showed it earlier. We're playing one of the very earliest adventures, this one, In Search of the Unknown, mm-hmm. which is technically set in what would become the Mystara setting, but that didn't really exist at the time. So they also said you could put it in Greyhawk in like one sentence, and that's all I needed. So I took that idea and then mixed it with another thing that I got. Actually, I hate to keep sort of being like, I know Gary Gygax had all the answers. Maybe not. But in some cases, he really knew what he was talking about. And in one of his two books that he published, either Mastering the Game or Dungeon Mastery, speaking of things I got at the library when I was like nine, there was a theory that he espoused in there called the bullseye method of setting design. And it was take a look at your setting, and in this case, where you're going to set your campaign. And you need the most detail on the stuff that's at the center of the bullseye. And you could think about this in terms of a map, right? And so if it's set in the city of Greyhawk, you need to know a lot about the city of Greyhawk. Maybe you don't. You need to know a little bit about the kingdoms immediately around it because they're going to have some contextual interaction. And then the further you go out, you can paint it a little lighter. It's you know, the Baclunish lands off to the side. There, that's kind of like the Arab lands. Oh, OK, I get that. Maybe eventually the campaign goes there. But until it does, you do not need to go into the 10,000 year history of that empire or whatever. So what I did. Is the thing said you can set this adventure here in the Timberway Forest in Northern Radic. And so I just cut out this portion of the map and shared it with people and gave them just a quick rundown of local stuff. What's going on? This used to be part of the Great Kingdom. They recently signed a treaty with these barbarians to the north, but it's a tenuous truce, and the land in between Radic, which was once the northern extent of the Great Kingdom, and the barbarians is this sort of no man's land called the Borderlands. And you're escaping from a town and you need to go up in there. You need to come up with a reason why you're fleeing town and why you want to take up at this mysterious keep on the borderlands up there. Here are a couple of the human cultures. Here's a handful of gods. There's like 100 gods plus in Greyhawk, but I only said here's 4 or 5 like relevant ones. And it kind of helped channel people towards stuff that was going to be more relevant to the campaign. So Think about what players do. They go on adventures. They go back to town. They get healing. They get a little religious instruction. They have to buy equipment. So you need to really lavish the most detail on the things that the players are actually going to interact with. So if you're spending a bunch of time talking about the economy and what Electrum pieces are called or whatever up front, then there's just too much overload. You know, if instead during the first time they buy something, that's when you mention, oh, the coin has an image of the old king of the Great Kingdom of Erdi. And that, you know, that's because this used to be a dependency of that. Oh, okay. I get it. So you sort of slowly unravel.
Slow drip lore.
Yeah. I think, and it's that whole, show don't tell, like Jared was talking about. Show them what the themes are like, show them what the setting is like. You could do that through art. I think that's a really interesting idea, but you can also do it through play. And I think players haven't made that investment yet in your campaign. They've invested this, I'm going to sit down with you and play for 4 hours, but they haven't kind of fallen in love with what you're selling. And you've got to do that gradually, I think. So you do need to prep more than what the players are ever going to interact with, of course, but don't overprep. I think overprepping is a huge mistake in RPGs because it makes you feel like, oh, well, I wanted them to go to the lighthouse because I spent all my weekend working on the lighthouse, but they're not interested in the lighthouse at all. They want to go to the barn. I'm going to force them to go to the lighthouse. That's not going to really work. So I think you need to do a light touch and then in between sessions, try and fill out the things that they've shown that they're interested in.
Yeah.
And then you wing it.
Do you ever, you know, one thing I did with that Corvosa Gazetteer is I cut out using, you know, like PDF, literally extracting pages. I cut out like a smaller version of it that I sent to some of the players ahead of time. Would you, like, if you were going to play in Eberron, Jared, would you send the players an Eberron book, like, weeks before you ever got together? Or would not send them a book and get them in person first and just start chatting in a session zero?
I think the players all having the book is a good idea. But, again, you can't force it on them and you can't go in expecting that they read anything. You know, I think that giving them the book, showing them the book to have them get the general impression is a good idea. But that's what they're going to do. They're going to get the general impression, which is often that's enough, you know, just having them have kind of a general idea of what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. The trickiest part to me is when you have completely different classes and completely different races, ancestries, right? Like that's when it's like, so what does this mean? You got to go. I think that sending the book ahead of time is important for stuff like that. Just to go back a second, I liked this apple tart on Twitch after you gave the lighthouse analogy. Eric said, quote, it's a very tall circular barn with a big light on the top.
Yeah, that's dungeon mastery right there. Sorry.
Yeah.
Now that's dungeon mastery right there. Okay. Let's get into our last segment here because this is a big deal. This is going to be fun. We love doing Beat McD when we get a chance to do it. Eric Skid, you can take a front row seat to this. What we're looking for now is anybody to raise their hand to enter the contest to compete against McD in D&D settings trivia. I mean, this is going to be very general and not super specific from what Jared says about the questions that he's asking. He says they're pretty surface questions. They're pretty easy is what he says.
They're so surface. And if you were paying attention to the entire episode here, some of the answers have already been revealed.
Ooh.
So,
oh wow, really? Okay,
this is one. This is one a caller can actually win. I believe it.
Okay, great.
You can beat McD this time. I know it.
I'm grabbing dice here as I see people weigh in. So, yeah, get your hands up there. And okay, this is great. We got a lot of entries this time. Oh, people think they know settings, McD. You might be in trouble. Okay.
Maybe I should have made it harder.
What the hell? All right, let's. I'm going to roll a die here and pick somebody. Okay, it's going to be Bent Paddle is the way that die rolled. Bent Paddle, can you hear us?
Hey, can you hear me?
We got you. Welcome to Beat McD. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going great. I did not expect you to choose me because I know very little.
Oh, great. Well, then why'd you raise your hand?
That's disappointing. Do you want to step down?
There's no shame. We'll have you on the show again.
I'll step down and I'll let someone.
You're
going to
give it a shot?
We have our first forfeit.
I feel like every time we do Beat McD, the person we pick is like, oh, by the way, I'm clueless. Let's go.
Wow. We had our first forfeit.
Awesome.
Geez.
Oh, did he forfeit?
Well, you know, he said, I'll step down and let somebody else that knows more.
Bent Paddle, that you are a great man. That is a strong, strong person.
Picturing McD in the
we'll
background.
We'll have you on
going,
the show again.
A picture of McD in the background going, yes, and then going, shit. after
he's
he walks
up one
away.
Nothing. He's up one game to nothing already. He can't lose.
Okay. Let's McD's already in the soundproof. He's soundproofed. He can't hear us anyway. All right, let's go to somebody else. Let's go to Grey Wolf. Grey Wolf 85. Yeah, we had a lot of people who disconnected when they weren't picked. That was funny. Grey Wolf 85, can you hear us?
Yes. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Are you ready to beat McD?
I'm so not ready, but let's do it.
Okay, let's give it a try. All right, so here I'll
all right, we can't have another forfeit, Grey Wolf,
can't
so
do another
I
forfeit.
Guess you're the guy.
All right,
I'll go through the rules with you. Okay, there's five questions, all right? After Jared finishes asking the first question, I'm going to start the timer. You have 60 seconds to answer as many of these five questions as you can correctly as possible. Jared will read the questions. You will get a chance to answer. You may pass on any question you want and then return to it later. Once the 60 seconds is up, you're done. Then we're going to bring up McD, and we'll see what how he does against you. If you're able to beat McD, you would be the first to beat McD. He hasn't lost yet. And you will win yourself a GCN Stealth Black hat.
Do McD second? I thought we did McD first, and then
McD second. McD second. And we also
second.
Don't tell McD what the target number is. Don't tell him what the person got ahead of time.
All right.
So we just want him to go in blind and see what he can do. All right. Get ready. Jared, whenever you're ready, Gray, are you ready? Or I'm sorry, Grey Wolf, are you ready?
Yes.
All right, so once, Jared, you finish reading the first question, I will start the clock whenever you're ready, Jared.
All right, question one. What was the first ever D&D campaign setting created by Dave Arneson and published in 1975?
Forgotten Realms?
Incorrect. Defilers and Preservers are types of magic users in what campaign setting?
Gray Hook.
Incorrect. What campaign world has been the setting for the video games Pool of Radiance, Neverwinter Nights, and Baldur's Gate?
Oh, wait. Campaign world?
Yeah, what campaign setting?
I want to say Forgotten Realms again. I know that's D&D.
Correct. We're going to give you that one.
Cool.
I want to say, just say your answer. Mask of Red Death was an Edgar Allan Poe inspired subsetting for which D&D campaign setting?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I'm going to pass.
Time. Okay. Time. Wow. Damn. Yeah. All right. Just one, Gray. Just one, unfortunately. But
Gray Wolf, very bad. That was very bad. Not you didn't have a mastery of the subject matter. That was clear.
No, not at all.
You could still win.
You could still win. Hang if in McD there, has some sort of life-altering aneurysm.
All right, let's bring McD up. If he can see, he's coming in now. Let us know when you're here, McD, when you can unmute your mic. I keep calling you Great Gray because of Great Gray Squid. Gray Wolf, just hang in there for a second. McD, can you hear us?
Yo, buddy.
Okay, McD,
You're not going to win this time, pal. Okay.
All right, here we go. Jared, ask the first question whenever you're ready. Remember, McD, you get 1 minute, and you can pass if you want and return to an answer. Here we go. I'll start the clock after Jared finishes the first question.
Question one, what was the first ever D&D campaign setting created by Dave Arneson and published in 1975?
Is the setting called Blackmoor? Blackmoor?
That's correct.
Great.
Question two, defilers and preservers are types of magic users in what? Dark Sun is correct. Question three, what campaign world has been the setting for the video games Pool of Radiance, Neverwinter Nights, Baldur's Gate? Forgotten Realms is correct. Mask of Red Death was an Edgar Allan Poe inspired subsetting for which D&D campaign setting?
Huh. I mean, I'll context clue that one. Ravenloft. Right?
That's correct. Sure. And you're going to get this one. Tasselhoff Burfoot was a member of what race native to Kryn, the world of the Dragonlance campaign setting?
What were they called? They were called Kinder? No,
I'm gonna say enough. That's right.
We'll
that's
a five, we'll accept five. It. Five out of five once wow. again. Well, that's back to back 5 out of 5s for McD. Very.
I was kidding, McD. I was kidding. Gray Wolf got. Did he get one?
He got one
I
think right.
He got one right.
Oh. Yeah.
So no one's ever going to beat McD. No one's ever going to do it.
Thanks for the attempt, Gray Wolf. Please, hey. You never know. You never know. Thanks.
You never know. You never know. Jared said,
well, thanks for calling in.
So I took him at his word.
Yeah. Some of those were not surface level, Jared.
No. You didn't think they were easy?
Eric thought they were easy.
Those were easy?
Can I give you like three really quick, actually hard setting questions?
Yeah, go.
McD,
So McD, around the era of Greyhawk and Blackmoor, TSR published another campaign setting that was not for Dungeons & Dragons. And it eventually was republished in a game called Empire of the Petal Throne. What was the name of that campaign setting?
Oh, dude,
I've got it.
Yeah, I guess anyone can answer these if you don't
know. Tecumel.
That's right, Tecumel.
Oh, okay.
The famous centerpiece of the Planescape setting is a city known as Sigil that hovers over a plane that in second edition was called the Outlands. What was the name of the Outlands in first edition AD&D?
Whoa, dude. No idea. That's really hard.
Limbo? Jared? Limbo?
Was it Limbo? Wait, no, hold on. It's
Oh, he's got something. Everybody shut up. Skids, shut
Wikipedia.
I was thinking Wild Space. It's not
It
wild
was
space.
Called the Plane of Concordant Opposition.
Concordant Opposition.
I've heard of that.
Opposition. Jared asked a question about Kender in Dragonlance. I'm going to ask a question about a evil race in Dragonlance called Draconians. Now, everyone was slightly different. What was unique about what happens to a Draconian when it reaches 0 hit points?
They turn to stone.
I know.
And they explode.
Yeah, that's right. They do. You got
they
that
turn to stone,
right?
Right?
They explode. And then they blow up.
Yeah.
All right. One last question, I guess, since we're on the topic of Kender.
This is great.
Kender are particularly well known for a very specific kind of slingshot / pole arm / quarterstaff that is sort of the cultural weapon of their people.
Right.
What is the name of weapon favored by Kender?
No clue, but what a great question.
That is a great question. I know it makes a scary sound when they whirl it around. They use that as defense. It is called a... Gosh. Huh. I forget what that is. Weapon is called the something sling.
Close. Not even close. The answer is the Hoopak. It's a Hoopak. There you go, folks. There's your hard trivia.
I'm putting Hoopak in all of my campaign worlds.
That would be there is hard trivia. Yeah, we had a few people in chat that said that said, yeah, those were easy questions. Yeah. And a couple of people that were like, you thought those were easy? So it was really kind of back and forth. It depends on how much you know.
Guys, I have to make them easy.
No, McD I know.
He keeps five out of fiving them against you.
Yeah.
If one of you would step up and actually compete, maybe I'd make it a little harder.
Yeah, maybe we need to have, maybe we need to have a little bit. And well, the other thing we could do is make it a little bit more, maybe we could make it a little more, do a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? Screening. Maybe do a little bit more screening. Yeah, vetting.
Oh, yeah, a little bit more vetting. Like, yeah.
Do you actually know about this stuff or not? Like, we'll ask them ahead of time.
Yeah. Pass them some sort of like multiple choice quiz to enter in, like I had to do when I tried to be on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Yeah, like Jeopardy.
There you go. But just the idea of saying like, hey, raise your hand if you want to compete in this, I think is
I'm going to just tell the staff, create a quiz that people have to.
Let me just tell the staff.
Tell my friends. You're telling them. Yep.
You're talking to the staff right now.
You're not staff. You're not staff. You're a host.
Guys, we got to go. This was so much fun. Eric Mona, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time and being on Glass Cannon Radio.
Hell yeah.
It is an absolute pleasure to have you guys here for the whole show. That was great. And we look forward to having you again on any kind of different topics we could talk about. It's always a joy to get your guys' insight and thoughts on these TTRPG or just general nerdy subject matters. It's really fun. So.
Thank you guys. This
thank
is so
you guys.
Fun.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. We can't wait to do it again sometime. So, all right, that's going to wrap it up for us for Glass Cannon Radio this week. Thanks everybody for coming by, hanging out, chilling with us. McD remains undefeated. So exciting. He's the man. We'll see if anybody
can
take
him. You'll never beat him. You're not strong enough.
And don't forget the Black Tongue Thief. Don't forget The Black Tongue Thief by Christopher Bowman. Pick it up, read it, and let's and hang out with us for book club.
One month from now.
All right, take it easy, everybody. We'll see you again soon, I hope. Bye.
Bye.
It's time to make your membership official. Start your 30-day free trial today and become an official member of The Naish at jointhenaish.com with the promo code GCN30. That's jointhenaish.com and use code GCN30 to gain access to exclusive podcasts, ad-free episodes, and content you can't find anywhere else. Once again, it's jointhenaish.com and use code GCN30 at signup to get your first 30 days for free. Tell your friends, come join yourself and see what everybody's talking about when you join The Naish today.